trust that our study tonight will help to deepen any impressions that have already been made for good in this assembly tonight. We have guests with us, and we're glad to see them. I see a number that I've known in past days, and they're visiting with us, and that's good. This is a continuation, part two, of a sermon that we've chosen to title, If I Were Young, or you might say, If I Were Young Again. If you have your Bibles, turn in the 37th Psalm, Psalm 37. This psalm is interesting to the Christian, I think, on a number of counts. The first thing that I think we will notice in the psalm that arrests our attention is the fact that Jesus quoted from it in the Sermon on the Mount. He spoke in that sermon about the meek shall inherit the earth, and he quoted from the 11th verse of this psalm. It's also interesting to us because this psalm is frequently quoted by false teachers, that is, people who have embraced an idea that's wrong. It's an inadequate view of what the Bible teaches, and its inadequacy can be exposed in the very text which is used to support it. If you'll notice in verse 23, it says, the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way. And though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholdeth him with his hand. That text is frequently used, a text which is encouraging us by the fact that the Lord is with us. It's used to encourage people in the belief that though you might sin, you can't so sin as to be utterly separated from God. That is, the impossibility of apostasy. But the chapter itself answers it. Look at verse 27. Depart from evil and do good and dwell evermore. That's the key. The obvious point is that no, we cannot be lost if we flee from what's wrong and embrace that which is right. But the text, or the part of the text that we have been using this day, is verse 25. I have been young and now am old. Yet have I not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. I made some personal application of that I have been young, and now in some people's minds I could be considered old. Surely in the minds of those that are very young. I know I felt about someone my age when I was your age. And what I wanted to try to do was to talk about some things that we would do well to learn when we're young. And perhaps all of us are young enough to learn all of them. And I tried to share some of those ideas with you. Because I believe that we live in a time in which we need to be fighting for those that are young. Or to put it another way, we need to be making a struggle to help direct the lives of those that are young. I appreciate a slogan that was used a number of years ago by the United States Marine Corps. They said, no one wants to fight, but someone had better know how. We may not want to, as Christians, to get locked in a struggle with the forces of our culture. But I'm going to tell you something. Some of us better know how to do it. Because the forces of our culture are ravaging, yea, our youth. We live in a modern society, you know, where comfort is high and freedom is virtually boundless, and pain, if not abolished, is on the list of things that are going to be abolished. And we're told a lot of things. But young people need to understand that there is going to be an inevitable disappointment wanting contradictory things at the same time. You cannot listen to the siren call of this world that offers many things and ever hope to grow in that kind of spiritual dimension that makes it possible for us to dwell with the Creator of this world forever. Emerson said, we boil at different degrees. Of course, some Americans do not boil at all. It just, nothing would happen that would upset them. We live in a time in which it can be said that TV has become junk food for the mind. Now, if we worry about the junk food that our children put into our bodies, what about their minds? It has been said that one must swallow a toad before breakfast to be sure of experiencing anything more distasteful before you go to bed. We're filled with a lot of things that are incredible that it's ever happened in our culture. And the effect that it's having upon those that are young is unmistakable. The 20th century did not invent vulgarity. But it did invent technologies like television that are used for the commercial exploitation of vulgarity. And let me ask you this question. Is it progress if a cannibal eats with a knife and a fork? To those that are young, I'd like to share with you, not from a rich well of wisdom, from the standpoint of saying, here's John Clark, and who is he with this pious, arrogant, you know, egotism, telling us what life is all about. It does have a ring to some extent of talking about, well, now if I were young. But the things I've learned since I began to try to be a preacher of the gospel, and the things that I've learned by trying to apply those things to people's lives and share those things with them, have come to my mind, and I can say that I have been young and now I'm old. And I can say I've never seen the righteous forsaken or the seed begging for bread, in the sense that the truly righteous people, I've seen God bless them and enrich them, and they have not been left alone. And I've seen other things too, and I want to share some of that with you now. By way of review, and I tell people that when you review that I don't believe in Jericho sermons. That's, you march around the same point several times and then shout. I don't want to do that, but I do want to quickly review some of the things that I talked about. I talked about how that if I were young, I'd form good habits. Because we're going to form habits. That's just a part of living. About 20 years ago, it was very popular to talk about a sign that had been seen by many people going into Canada. The roads in Canada were in very poor condition, at least in the western section of it. And you come down this road and suddenly you'd see a big sign and it said, "The road is rutted ahead. Be careful what rut you choose. You're going to be in it for the next 30 miles." Well, we do get into ruts in life. It's the way life is. We form habits. And we better be careful what rut we get in, because if we're not careful, we'll be in it the rest of our lives. So form good habits. I think that's one of the lessons to learn. And we pointed out that Christ went into the synagogue, the Bible says in Luke 4, verse 16, as was his custom. He'd learned to do that. Then we pointed out that if I were young, I'd meet life's requirements. As Jesus said, I must work the work of him that sent me while it is day. There's some things you have to do. In this life, there are certain things you have to do. You're going to have to take care of physical needs. You're going to have to face temptation. It happens to everyone. You're going to have to face the judgment. The kind of choices that we make in this life are going to be evaluated by our God. You're going to have to face change. It's all around us. There's no way to escape it. Change is inherent in our physical existence. It's inherent in this world. And you're going to have to face that. And also, you're going to have to face suffering. Let me continue with this tonight by the following points. If I were young, I'd like to learn, have someone teach me, imbibe of the truth that I need to avoid being half-baked in life. In Hosea chapter 7 and verse 8, when the prophet was describing the northern kingdom, Ephraim is a cake not turned. It was half-baked. Too many times we're lopsided. I believe when the New Testament talks about being sound in the faith, I believe that that word sound, if you'll carefully study it, will give you the meaning of wholeness. That there is a completeness about it. That there is a balance, a symmetry about it. There are some people, as Christians, that are real strong on certain things, but they are just as weak as water on something else. In Luke 2:52, was not the description of Jesus that we read a great help when we thought about this matter? Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. There was a physical and a mental and a spiritual and a social development perceived in the life of Jesus, and it ought to be in the life of every young person growing up. And we need to avoid being half-baked. The ancient Greeks talked about what was called the golden mean. Let me illustrate. I think a little bit of thought will convince us that courage is a virtue that we need, and I'll speak more about that. But sometimes we get these things unbalanced. Life is a balance between cowardice on the one hand and recklessness on the other hand. And it's very difficult for people to balance those together, it seems. And true courage is not the total absence of fear. It exists, but in spite of that fear, it acts in certain ways, but it doesn't go to the other extreme and act reckless. The Greeks call this the golden mean. An attitude toward money. We're taught in the Bible to be generous. We ought to be, imitating God, free in our giving. But there's a balance that we need to seek, the golden mean. On the one hand, most of us can perceive the absurdity of the miser. The person who holds his money is so tight with a death grip. Of course, he's going to, in his death, let go of that grip, but he's a fool. But that's masked oftentimes by the person who maybe under the influence of alcohol goes around and empties his wallet in some foolish-headed show of generosity. So we advise people to function under what we call the golden mean, to have a wise use of money. Not too much holding it and not too freely just giving it away. There are people who are said to be generous to a fault. And so what we're talking about by not being half-baked. There needs to be a balance not only in our concern about social and physical and mental and spiritual things, but also in many other things in life. We need to avoid being half-baked. Do you remember the story that the famous poet Ovid told about the father and the son, Daedalus and Icarus, and how that they had been cast up on the island of Crete. They were prisoners there and they wanted to get away, and they finally figured out a way. The father made some wings, and he made them out of wax and out of feathers, and they were going to, they worked for a long while, learned how to fly, you know, and they were going to leave. But before they left, the father admonished the son, "Son, do not fly too low, for our enemies will see us. Do not fly too high, you will get near to the sun. It's dangerous." In other words, just in between. Well, of course, what happened is, the older man, you know, taking his own advice, he escaped. His son took his flight, but he became so exhilarated with his flying, and this was great, he was going up and up and up and up and up, and you know the tragic end of the story. Got so close to the sun, the wax melted, and he plunged to earth into his death. He may need to take the advice of the little boys that formed the club, and they said, "Nobody act big, nobody act small, everybody act medium." We need to live life not being half-baked. There's some people who go running off on one extreme, and there's that lack of balance, and everybody can see it seems like, except them. Let's give attention in our youth, and let's give it all the days of our life to have a balance. As Jesus grew in wisdom, develop our minds, but not to the place where, because we're getting, you know, one of the saddest things is to see someone extremely gifted mentally. I mean, they got a high IQ. And then it turns them into an arrogant kind of a monster. They're half-baked. We need to develop physically. Isn't it sad to see somebody that has a marvelous physique and they have tremendous physical powers? Because I lacked it, I always sort of admired people who had such tremendous control of their bodies that they could do marvelous things on the athletic fields. But what about someone who's built like a Greek god, who can throw a football or shoot a basketball or enter into track games, but he's a bully and he has no sense of appreciation of others? He's half-baked and he's in for all kind of problems. There are people who are so concerned about being socially acceptable that they give little thought to their spirituality. and they're willing to trade almost anything for popularity. That's a half-baked person. That's one of the things that I've learned. I was young, and now I'm old. If I were young, I'd encourage myself. Now, we're not talking about that kind of arrogance that goes around saying, "You're really great," or the little girl that looks in the mirror. You ever seen this little girl walks up and says, "Oh, beautiful, beautiful," looking at her face. I'm not talking about that. But you know, I found among those that are young, their image of themselves is not as good as it ought to be. Read with me from 1 Samuel chapter 30 and verse 6. David got himself into a mess. He left a city unguarded. It was plundered. He showed himself to be so foolish in that his own troops were ready to turn on him. And it says this about him: "But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God." You know, someone says, well, and they might read that taking out of its context. Well, why not? Here's David. You know, he's got everything going his way. After all, he's a king. He's wealthy. You know, he's got everything. No, that's not the picture at all. What you've got here is someone that's got a lot of things against him. But he encouraged himself in the Lord. It's great to have those who can encourage us, isn't it? One of the things that we read, I think, with great interest, we relish to read about a man named Barnabas, that the early disciples wanted to change his name. They called him, his name was Joseph, but they changed it to Barnabas because they wanted to call him a son of consolation. He was a great encourager. It's wonderful to have those about us that can encourage us. It's great to have that in a local congregation. People who are always encouraging. And there are people like that here. But also it's important to be able to encourage ourselves. We need to be self-starters. Do you remember, any of you, I'm sure you do. There's some people out there as hoary-headed as I am, and even more. You remember back when to start a car you had to crank it? And you'd see bruises on men's arm and everything because they'd get down there and they'd crank that thing and they'd catch it a certain thing and it'd spring back, and if they didn't get out of the way, whoop, it hit your arm. And you'd see they'd get up and get that thing going, and then the car would start. Now what do? Go out, put the key in, it starts like that and just take off. Isn't it wonderful to have something that is self-starting? You don't have to get out there and just worry yourself. If you still had to have those starters like that, you'd have the following things. Probably be a lot of women that wouldn't drive. Now, I'm not just, that's not putting you down, but I mean, and there'd be a lot of men that would quit it. But the great value of having something that just starts up like that. We need to be self-starters. We need to be the kind of people, and I say that, one thing I've learned, and I would wish that all that are young could learn that. That we need to be able to encourage ourselves. Now, courage is important. It's essential in the business of living. I went to Birmingham, Alabama to hold a meeting. And I saw a man there that I had met in Indiana. When I saw him in Indiana, he was just doing wonderful. He was a medical doctor. And because of his profession, because the helping professions usually are rewarded monetarily, he was doing wonderful and well. He had several children. But when I saw him in Birmingham, I realized that something was wrong. I could tell it. You didn't have to have somebody write it out. I could tell. I noticed that he had a couple of canes, and he's a fairly young man. And he has a disease in his limbs that has limited. In fact, he's, at least for a while, has had to quit, as we'd say, doctoring. And I preached some sermons during that meeting, and I could just see his eyes just glisten with tears. And I could see that this man is having a battle. He's having a battle because of his physical condition. And not only that, but his mental condition, because he wants to support his family. He wants to be able to do things, and he's limited. And particularly, he's aware of the gravity of this disease because he's a doctor. And he spoke to me about this. And I tried to speak, as I always try to do in meetings, because I tell you this,
you can preach on a lot of things, but I know one thing you can preach on, and most of the time people will appreciate it, and that is the kind of things to encourage us and to make us feel strong and positive about what we believe. And he talked somewhat to me about this. And he shared with me that at this time he had a great need of courage. And the man is finding within himself the thing to encourage himself. We need courage. And I think a lot of times when I look at young people, I would like to say to you, if I were young again, I'd encourage myself. I'd think of all the assets and the things that I have. And I wouldn't focus my attention so much upon the negative things and the things that I think are liabilities, but I would just focus upon the things that are good. You know, cowardice, just like courage, is contagious. You let one or two people get afraid, and I don't care who they are, and they start running, and you know what'll happen? Others will run too. Do you remember the story of Chicken Little? Chicken Little was out in the garden one day when a cabbage leaf fell on her tail. This world-shaking event filled her with utter terror. Remember reading this story in the books? You used to have these readers, McGuffey readers, and they'd have these moral stories in them. Therefore, she began to run with all her might, and by, as she ran, she met Hen Pen. You remember that? This wise bird, seeing the despair on the face of Chicken Little, asked the cause, and having been informed that the sky was falling, Hen Pen joined in the stampede. And then they met Duck Luck, and then Goose Loose, and then Turkey Lurk. You remember all those characters? At last, they met Fox Lox. You remember him? Now, when they had informed him of the tragedy, he told them of the lovely air raid shelter that he had prepared for just such an emergency. Therefore, they all ran into his den, and the fox lived happily for many days thereafter. It is the story of unparalleled silliness. But there is this much truth in it. Let the most insignificant person stampede, and others have a great tendency to stampede also. Cowardice is very contagious. I would say to the young Christian today, encourage yourself. Don't follow the stampede of those who in cowardice are opting to run from this life and from its problems. We need to be strong in the Lord. Fear not at the door. Faith answered and found there was no one there. If I were young again, I'd encourage myself. Further, if I were young again, I'd live positively. I want to read something that our Lord taught us in Matthew chapter 12. Listen to this. Verses 43 and 44. Well, 45. When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places seeking rest and findeth none. And then he saith, I will return into my house from whence I came out. And when he is come, he findeth it empty, swept, and garnished. Then goeth he and taketh with himself seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. Even so shall it be also unto this wicked generation. The idea of a spirit leaving, and now the house is clean. No evil there. And so the evil spirit comes back with even more. I want to say to you that our Lord tried to teach us, and the apostles have tried to teach us, and if I were young, I'd want to learn this lesson. I'd live positively. Emptiness of evil is not the equivalent of goodness in our life. It is not. Harmlessness is never holiness. You. In other words, I think a lot of people make the mistake of having this negative idea. I do not do this, I do not do that. This evil is not in my life, thank God I am not like that. Go over and look at the example of Moses. The story of Moses would not mean very much to us if all we ever saw was the abhorrence and the turning away from what was wrong. Hebrews chapter 11. It says this: by faith, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. If it ended there, it would not mean near as much as it does when it says, choosing rather to suffer the affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasure of sin for a season. What I'm trying to get at is that it's not a measure of a life before God that's approved to simply have the absence of evil in our life. In fact, we must go further and say that even with the absence of evil, without the presence of good, that's sinful. James 4 and verse 17, it says, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. You show me people's lives which are bent upon the idea of, and as they properly ought to, opposing the evils of our time, the immoralities of our day, the vulgarities that are a part of our culture. And if that is the sum and substance of what they are, they set themselves up ultimately for the picture that Jesus drew of the house that's swept and clean, and now seven spirits that are evil enter into it. I've seen too many people who made a determination to turn away from wrong, but they did not develop in their lives that kind of continuous, positive doing of good. We cannot measure our spirituality by saying, thank God I'm not as wicked as others. We're going to have to see that our life will be measured on the basis of living positively. When someone says, I'm not so bad, I don't do anything wrong, that's not enough. And we have to learn that. The principle that nature abhors a vacuum should be a warning to us that it's not enough to simply cleanse our lives of some positive evil. We've got to fill our lives with that which is good. And that's important to learn. If young people see us who are older preaching against the wrongs of our time, but not at the same time practicing in our lives the kind of things which are the positive radiation of good, they are seeing a model that is not fit to follow. If I were young, I'd grow up. And I guess I have to, you know, to protect myself from what I would think would be untoward criticism, I have to admit I am still growing up. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 11. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I thought as a child, I understood as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. A 7-pound baby is a delight. A 150-pound baby may be a horror. If I were young again, I'd grow up. What do babies do? Now, babies are given to tears, and we understand that. They cry a lot, don't they? But they cry over trifles, right? Now, to them at the moment it's very important, but they cry over trifles. I mean, they're holding this and sits out there, you know, and to them it's as if it is an earthquake that's shaking the entire globe. Yeah, babies are given to tears. And they are very concerned about personal calamities. Something that's taken away from them is the end of the world, you know. We understand that. That's babies. They love attention. They just love to be the center of attention. And you know, the first time they ever walk, you know, you're going, come on now, come on to daddy, you know, come on. And they get out there and they take a few steps and you just, hey, isn't that wonderful, you know? Well, we expect that. That's part of being a baby, isn't it, and growing up. And you know, babies take... And, you know, babies take life's blessings as a matter of course. Mother stays up all night with them. Well, that's just the way it is. I mean, babies, you know, they don't know any different. They just take the blessings that come to them from having a loving father and mother and all that around them. That's just a matter of course. Now, we don't find fault with that, do we? Until they get to be 150-pound babies. Babies have no sense of obligation. We don't expect them to have it. But when Paul said, when I was a child, I spake as a child and I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things, does that mean that Paul didn't cry any tears anymore? No. I tell you, if you read Paul's epistles, he was a New Testament Jeremiah, folks. In fact, he talks about sometimes when he's writing to the brethren, with a broken heart and with tears, and you can almost see them dripping down, you know. If he were writing the manuscript, you could see it there almost. Paul did a lot of crying, but he didn't cry over trifles. And I want to tell you this. If I were young, I'd learn not to cry over trifles. If we wept over the things that are tearing people's lives apart and are sending them to hell, if we wept over those things as much as we do over some of the personal trifles, love attention. You know, there are people in the church that if they don't run it, they're going to ruin it. Diotrephes. There are people, if they can't be in a position which they esteem to be of honor, they don't want to be in anything. They won't have attention. There are people who commit crimes. Why? Go out and shoot somebody to get their picture in the paper. We say something like that's going to be sick. But you know something? If we don't ever grow up, if we want to be perpetually babies, this is just an extension of this in the woes of our culture. To take life's blessings as a matter of course. I don't think about it maybe as frequent as I should, and sometimes it's more than I think I can safely think. But my mind goes back to my grandfather and grandmother and to my dad and my mother. My mother died when I was 5. And my father tried to take care of us children. And I'll tell you this, it's only been in my last few years that I even perceive what that man went through. We have no right to take life blessings as a matter of course. And when we're young, we need to learn to grow up. One of the things that you'll hate the worst is the fact that people will go on before you have a time to tell them how much you appreciate them. Shakespeare said, "How sharper than a serpent's tooth is a thankless child." When we grow up, we have a sense of obligation. It's a sign of immaturity to always thinking about what's happening to me, what I'm doing, and not how it affects others. Listen to Paul as he writes the Corinthian letter. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, he says, verse 15, I will gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved. It's a sign of maturity that casts off the shackles of self-importance and self-centeredness, and then begins to perceive the sense of obligation with which we ought to live. If I were young, I'd grow up, and I'm too young. In these areas of these things, I'm too much like a child. If I were young, I'd make folks treat me right. I want to combine two passages this morning in the lesson we referred to, 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12, where Paul says, "Let no man despise thy youth." And then Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, where it says, you know it, it's the golden rule, whatsoever you would that men do unto you, you do unto them. It's teaching the principle that life is an echo. What are the things that we desire? We want people to like us, don't we, unless there's something wrong with us? To take an interest in us. And for ourselves. We want people to really like us for ourselves. Now, you know, we may warm to someone who comes and smiles at us, you know, and says, "How are you?" And is very jovial. And he puts your arm around it, and you're just feeling, boy, you're just about to feel good. And they whip something out and says, "Say, have you seen this? I want to show this to you." And you say, "Oh." Because you get this chilling sense, they don't really care about me. We desire for people to like us. We also want people to look for the best in us, not the worst in us. Isn't that what we want? And we want a little appreciation. Even the Lord suggested this. When after he had healed the 10 lepers, only one came back, and what did Jesus say? "Where are the 9? Don't we want those things? But how are we going to get them? What are some of the strategies that people use to try to get people to do what? To like them and to pay some attention to them and take some interest in them. Here are some things that don't work. Ignore people. I never have understood the person that comes and just comes in and you ever seen it, this kind of thing? They run in services and they'll sit out, you know. And as soon as they run out the door, you know, and they get in the car and they're gone down the road and they're saying, "Boy, those people over there sure are unfriendly." I've seen people have to almost run out to try to get a hold of them. Now, I know that some people may have some things on their mind, and sometimes people just do not want to be with other people. When that's a continual practice thing, and they're going through life saying, "Well, I want people to pay attention to me." Let me tell you something. It won't work when you ignore others. The Bible teaches that he that would have friends must show himself friendly. And there's a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. Well, another way that people try to make this thing do and it won't work is to answer some slight with a greater slight. You know, perhaps someone is busy, something on their mind, and they're passing up, and they don't speak to you like you ought to. So in response to that, "Well, I'll just show them, boy." And so we're going to answer their slight with a greater one. It doesn't work. Another thing is compulsion. Like here's a couple of neighbors, and they got a problem about some boundary or some kind of fence or one of the children, so they come over, and here's the way some people operate. "Now, I'll tell you how it's going to be. I'm going to respect you, and you're going to respect me in this discussion." That's about like a fellow taking a gun, and he puts it to your head and says, "Now, you're going to love me, and I can just feel love warming up in me, you know. Until the artillery's put away." It doesn't work. Never has worked. What does work? You want people to be interested in you, you be genuinely interested in other people. That's the way it works. Life is an echo. Much of the time we get back what we send out. And you know something, when I'm talking about if I were young, I'd make folks treat me right. How do you make folks treat you right? By acting right. Now someone says, "Well, it may not work with everybody." If it works with anybody, it works because of that. You treat other people right. You know something? You're going to find, strangely enough, that if you're eager to judge other people kindly, they'll be more eager to judge you kindly. I'll guarantee you this. If you have someone that eagerly participates with you as you cut somebody else down, they will just as eagerly participate with someone else in cutting you down. Class and echo. We need to be able to express appreciation for others. I'll tell you this. If you start letting other people know that you truly appreciate them, there's many a woman that has fallen into the trap of always and endlessly criticizing her husband. She's on him night and day about something. When what she needs to understand is if she will send out appreciation, that will come back in many forms that you couldn't buy nor compel anybody to give you. It's also true vice versa. There's many a man that all he can think about is something to get on his wife about. I'll tell you this, life is an echo. And the golden rule is if you want to be treated right by others, you treat them right. And I'll tell you this, if I were young, I'd make folks treat me right by trying to act right. The story of the prodigal son always rings a bell with people because we can identify with that. And there are many things to be said about that story. But one of the most interesting things is that the boy ran away and the boy stayed at home. But the boy at home didn't treat his situation at home with his father like being a son. His attitude toward it was like it was sort of being a slave. And he got all angry when his father welcomed home his brother. And the father gently and tenderly tried to get him to see, "Son, you're ever with me and all that I have is yours." But that was not the attitude of the son toward his father. Not as a son, but as a slave. And you know something that teaches me? That God our Father cannot do some things for us until our attitudes toward Him change. And when our attitude toward God is not like some slavish service that we rendered Him, but we are His children and the sheep of His pasture, and we are blessed by Him, then some things can come upon us. Is it not important to learn that when you're young? Let me close this by going back to the text in Ecclesiastes. I said this morning that a lot of things were on my mind. I cannot, as a father, help but think about all of my children and my daughter going away to school and growing up. And she used to wince when I would do this, that when she was just a little one, I'll never forget, just as a little girl, she said, kind of had a little lisp in her voice, she said, "Don't do that, Daddy." Or say with that kind of special way that's hers and hers alone some things. Now she's grown up and she's going away to school. My daughter called from Florida and I was saying, "What'd she say? What'd she say?" Well, you know, has very little to say to Dad, but a whole lot to say to Mom. And I said, "What did she say?" And she was talking about Amy going away to college. And she said, she remembered that when she went away to college that I gave her this advice. And she says, "She's glad I did." And I said, "Well, what was that?" I was trying to remember what was this sage advice that I gave. And she said that I told her to be herself. Not to be phony, but to be herself. Her best self. And that someone would love her for that. Well, I give this advice to my daughter, Amy, and share it in the presence of you all. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse 9. "Rejoice, O young man or young woman, in thy youth." It's so wonderful to see her grow up, her beauty, her charm. her groping and searching for herself, wanting to be understood and appreciated, uncertain about the future, with what I hope is certain in our heart that we love her and that God loves her. And so we say to the young, and I would say this if I were young, I would want someone to tell me, John, rejoice. Enjoy this. Make it a good time in your life. And let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God shall bring thee into judgment. Therefore remove sorrow from thy heart. Remove certain things that are impediments to us being what we ought to be. And then remember. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. I hope that when Amy gets down to school, and in a moment when she hasn't got a lot of things going on, that she'll have thoughts of home and she'll remember. She'll remember our house and the things that go on there, and she'll remember you. And I do not intend for it to be maudlin sentimentalism, but a statement of how I truly, really believe that in a special way so many of you have been so nice and wonderful to my daughter and have encouraged her. And the relationships that she's established with so many of you and with your children are, in my opinion, a treasure. It wasn't very long until Amy knew not only the names, but all the birthdays of all the children in this congregation. She's loved your children and loved you, and I appreciate your love of her. And Amy? Yes, Amy. There is a good life in Christ Jesus. Rejoice. Remove. Remember. Remember.